You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up with the announcement that Foxconn has chosen Mount Pleasant as a site for its multi-billion dollar plant, we'll look at the water demands that could come with that deal. First, Russian hacking and social media campaigns were big stories in the 2016 election campaign. Our next guest says we're likely to see more hacking efforts like that in the future. The 2016 attacks targeted political parties, campaigns, and think tanks, and social media and fake news campaigns were directed at potential voters. But our next guest is worried about a new type of target, civil society organizations that she says are vital to a functioning democracy. Things like religious organizations, charities, activist groups, unions, and a number of other potentially vulnerable groups. Susan Landau joins us now. She's a professor at the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy and the School of Engineering's Department of Computer Science at Tufts University. Her forthcoming book is called Listening In, Cybersecurity in an Insecure Age. She wrote about Russian hacking at the Lawfare blog. Susan, thanks for joining us.
Thanks very much for having me.
Well, what kind of civil society organizations could be vulnerable to future Russian hacking?
In fact, some were during the last election. The Office of the Director of National Intelligence announced in January that organizations that were viewed as likely to help shape American political views had been the attempt, the Russians had attempted to hack some of these. And I talked with several, one of which had been informed by the FBI that they were a subject. These are the kinds of think tanks that help write policy papers that influence DC, but there are also organizations that influence public opinion, which then floats back, goes back towards the government.
Why would Russian hackers want to target these kinds of organizations instead of some of the higher, more prestigious things that we saw in the last election, looking for the White House, for instance?
When in democracies, civil society is extremely important. They're the social glue that connects the people with their legislators. Most people don't follow what happens in Congress every day and what happens in the State House. Instead, you have both the newspapers and the press, but you also have, whether it's Sierra Club or the American Cancer Society might say, might become involved in the issue of smoking as it did many years ago, or the National Academy of Sciences, or the Southern Poverty Law Center, or much smaller groups, the PTAs or the national PTAs. All of these different groups function within a democratic society to help connect the people and the government. If you're trying to disrupt a democracy, you try to disrupt the elections, but you also try to disrupt the people's connection to their government. And a very good way to disrupt it is through civil society.
As far as you know right now, are some of the groups that we were talking about, these civil society organizations, are they prepared to withstand an attack of hacking like this at that magnitude?
Well, in fact, nobody is prepared to really withstand an attack if a nation state is going against a particular target. It's very hard to do so. The question is whether or not they are well prepared, whether or not they're using sort of the best tools that we have now. And the answer is mostly not. Many of these civil society organizations are work on a threadbare budget. This is not the kind of attack they expected. Now, any organization I mention, I'm talking about as a hypothetical. None of them would say that they've been attacked and so on. But if you think of organizations like Planned Parenthood or the Southern Poverty Law Center, those are organizations that are used to being attacked in many ways. But if you think of something like Sierra Club or the American Bar Association or the American Cancer Society, those are not organizations that would expect to be the targets of attacks, let alone the targets of a country like Russia.
Now, at first glance, attacking, say, the Sierra Club, it doesn't seem as high stakes as targeting a voting system. So what kind of damage could be done?
So Sierra Club is trusted by many people. In fact, Sierra Club is one of those organizations whose membership jumped after the Reagan election, jumped after the Trump election, as people who cared about conservation said, gee, I have to do my work to protect the environment. Now, if Sierra Club's records were hacked, for example, if it were preparing a report about damage to the environment or threats to water, and that those reports turned out to be inaccurate because somebody tampered with the data, Sierra Club's reputation decreases and people feel disconnected. There was a book 20, 30 years ago called Bowling Alone, about how the U.S. has moved from a society that had a very vibrant civil society to one that's much less well-connected. And that may, in fact, have something to do with the divided country we now see. But it's civil society that connects us, so that when we have disagreements about whether or not funds should go to the libraries or to subsidizing school buses or schools, or whether we should put a low-income housing in a particular neighborhood. It's the civil ties that connect us that enable those decisions to go well together. But if you create distrust in civil society, then eventually you have a much less well-functioning democracy. This is something that Russia knows very well, having disrupted civil society in the Soviet Union after the Russian Revolution, and having done the same in Eastern Europe after the Second World War.
We're talking to Susan Landau right now from Tufts University. Her forthcoming book is called Listening In, Cybersecurity in an Insecure Age. And Susan, getting at more in the same vein that we were just talking about, you write about ClimateGate, a real-life example, and how that played out. Could you walk us through what we saw there?
Absolutely. That's a classic case. Thank you for asking me. So in ClimateGate, the emails from the climate study group at the University of East Anglia in the UK were stolen and then published. And journalists who opposed the idea, well, groups that opposed the idea that climate change was real and was happening, began to selectively quote, making it appear that the scientists who were working on climate change were exaggerating, were saying things that weren't scientifically true. And between the time the data was first taken and several years later, public support in the U.S. on climate change dropped significantly. That is to say, the public less believed in the issue and less believed in scientists. And that was an extremely good example of what happens when you have that kind of disruption.
And you describe that example, but also the Russian hacking campaign, as a new kind of warfare. How does that new kind of warfare operate?
So let me first tell you about the old kind of warfare. We anticipated that any kind of cyber attack would be a disruption of critical infrastructure, whether of the power grid or the financial sector or water and dams. This one instead works on people's heads, and it disconnects people from each other and from the government. In an authoritarian society, you're simply told what's going on, and there is no dissent. Whereas in democracies, you function by rich dissent and then rich coming together. But if you can't trust private sector organizations, if you can't trust the organizations between you and the governments, whether it is, in fact, the journalism, or it's through fake news, or these civil society organizations, you get a real disruption in the body politic. Nobody knows what's true, what's correct, and they stop trusting the sort of authorities that used to be trusted, like academia, like think tanks, like professional organizations. And it's very unhealthy.
Now, you say that this new kind of warfare is coming. In fact, you say it's already here. We're just going to see more of it. But how do we, who aren't maybe a player within these organizations, how do we, the public, get ready for something like this, to prepare ourselves mentally and with a community structure?
Well, one of the important issues is to start reading information really critically. This is something that we've, of course, always known in democracy, to distinguish between yellow journalism and serious journalism, but it's become much more important. I grew up in the era of Walter Cronkite and authoritative figures. Now, there are some problems with authoritative figures because there were many people who weren't allowed to be authoritative figures. But in a world where we don't have authoritative figures, learning to read the newspapers, the social media carefully, thoroughly, and with a really critical eye is very important. The other aspect, of course, is that we want to take information security far more seriously. So the kinds of steps that various of the companies are taking for two-factor authentication, so you have your phone, for example, which authenticates you to an online account, for using communications that are ephemeral. We used to talk on the telephone, then we moved to email and chat, but the problem with email and chat is that many of the conversations that you might want to be ephemeral, where you might make a critical comment about a colleague or a friend, you don't want that to stay around. It's one thing when you say it on the phone. It's another thing when it's an email. A third thing when it's an email that's published on the front page or the second page of the Washington Post or the New York Times. Things like that, we have to just learn to read and think far more critically, and we also have to use information security techniques far more broadly. And that's the second is a very unusual step for the public at large. But
Susan, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
That was Susan Landau, professor of law and diplomacy and computer science at Tufts University. Her forthcoming book is Listening In, Cybersecurity in an Insecure Age. The Taiwanese tech giant Foxconn recently announced that the location of their proposed electronics manufacturing plant will be in Mount Pleasant, Wisconsin. The $10 billion LCD screen manufacturing facility itself will need to be built, and in addition, it will need to be able to count on infrastructure from the surrounding municipalities. One must have for the plant the need to transport large quantities of water and to be able to treat that wastewater before it's discharged back into the environment. Scott Gordon is associate editor for wiscontext.org, and he's been looking at that issue. Scott, welcome back to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Scott, how much water is the Foxconn plant going to need?
Well, we don't know for sure, but people have kind of made estimates based on, you know, how much water, you know, these kinds of operations tend to use. You know, manufacturing electronics of any kind is a pretty water-intensive process because you're essentially layering all these fine components on top of each other, and they all have to be clean. So that takes a lot of water right there. And, you know, there's one estimate floating around out there from an electronics industry analyst who specializes in the displays area that it could be as much as, you know, 15 million gallons a day, which is, you know, what a moderate-sized city might use.
And you do a little bit of compare and contrasting in a piece you wrote about this, looking at the city of Waukesha, which is looking to divert water from Lake Michigan to the city of Waukesha for its needs. By comparison, what is Waukesha asking for?
Waukesha is asking for about 8 million gallons per day. And, I mean, they're getting it. They've got permission to do it. But they still have to build a lot of infrastructure and, you know, get a lot of construction permits and water permits sorted out before they can actually turn on the tap. And the interesting thing with Foxconn is it could potentially use a lot more water, and you know, they're looking to get that done a lot faster.
And you mentioned the speed in which things need to be done. How quickly does Foxconn need to get the infrastructure up and running? And it's not just Foxconn responsible for this infrastructure. It's also Racine and the water utilities there. But what is the timeline? What do we know about the timeline?
Well, they're looking to get this factory up and running by 2020. So, I mean, right there, that's obviously not that long of a period to build, you know, this huge factory that they're proposing, and it's also not that long to build quite a bit of water infrastructure that's going to have to go out there.
What do we know about the infrastructure needed?
Well, so they're going to be getting water from Racine's water utility. The water utility has confirmed that, and so they'll have to build, you know, some water mains going out from Racine's water plant, you know, west towards this location near Mount Pleasant, and it'll involve some new water mains and some existing water mains. You know, it's quite a lot of basically new pipes. And as they're doing this, they kind of also have to be thinking about what are other developments that might spring up around all this. And, you know, are these new water mains going to be able to serve that with water as well?
So when you talk about potential new development, you're saying it sounds like the potential of Foxconn, if it plays out as promised, could be huge, and it could spur development of satellite communities and growth in the area in general. So we're talking about planning for maybe development that isn't even there yet.
Yeah, and I mean, that's something that water utilities and cities do when they're building out, you know, their water infrastructure, their sewer infrastructure, or, you know, roads or anything else. Is they're ideally thinking kind of long term about, you know, what other needs will pop up, not just kind of the current need or near future needs that they're trying to serve. So in that sense, that's not an unusual thing for people to be thinking about.
When the city of Waukesha got permission to source its water from Lake Michigan, they had to, it was a long process. There was a lot of back and forth that involved the Great Lakes Water Compact. Will Foxconn have to do any of those things that the city of Waukesha had to do?
Basically, no. And I guess we could get really into the weeds on how the Great Lakes Compact works. But it kind of all depends on where you are, where the utility that you're getting your water from is, where they're allowed to send water. You know, Waukesha sits, the whole city of Waukesha sits outside the Great Lakes Basin. They're in a county that straddles the Great Lakes Basin. And so under the Great Lakes Compact, they were allowed to ask for what's called a diversion to get access to the water. And they succeeded in that, obviously, and it was a long process. They were also the first city to undergo that process. So people saw it as kind of a test. With Foxconn, they're getting it from Racine. It's Racine basically selling water to a customer and sending it to a place that it's allowed to send the water already. And basically, at that point, the enforcement of the Great Lakes Compact is largely up to the state. And they've kind of decided to streamline that in the incentives package that they put together. You know, there are some things that could kind of trigger greater scrutiny from the other seven states involved in the Great Lakes Compact. You know, if the plant starts using, you know, a lot more water than it's able to put back, for instance, in the form of treated wastewater, then that's a problem where the bigger sort of, you know, multi-state aspect of all of this pops in. And, you know, I mean, there's concern that the Great Lakes Compact is a relatively new agreement and that, you know, it's only been tested so much. And people have expressed concerns that the Waukesha decision, you know, showed maybe some weaknesses in how it's enforced. So I'm sure people will be watching, but it's kind of a hairy issue where there are things that require the approval of all eight Great Lakes states and areas where the individual states have some discretion.
We're talking to Scott Gordon right now, associate editor for WisContext.org, talking about the water needs for the Foxconn development, which is to come in the near future here in Wisconsin. And Scott, you talked about Foxconn getting to, you use the word streamline, some environmental regulations as part of its incentive package. How do you see that playing out when it comes to water usage?
Well, the thing is, it kind of seems a little bit uncertain at this point. You know, one big source of concern, environmentally speaking, when it comes to Foxconn, is that electronics manufacturing, you know, like any big industry, like uses all kinds of different chemicals, all kinds of different things that you wouldn't want getting out into the groundwater or into a lake or stream or wetlands. And it's not clear how that's going to be handled. You know, there isn't, they're not going to be required to submit an environmental impact statement before beginning construction. So I think the public might have a little bit of a hard time actually scrutinizing the project from that standpoint ahead of time. And so we don't really know yet how they're planning to treat the water that's going to be coming out. And again, if they're using water from the Great Lakes, they do have to send most of it back, again, in the form of treated wastewater, which means they've got to find some way to treat it. And, you know, obviously electronics manufacturers know how to do that, but there's obviously all sorts of problems that have arisen with that and, you know, all sorts of pollution that have occurred with Foxconn in, you know, in some of its operations around the world.
Right. You wrote about one aspect of that that was kind of interesting, that electronics manufacturers use a technique to boil down water, and apparently they're left with some kind of waste cake. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, it's appealing. That's one way of getting rid of all the heavy metals that are used in electronics manufacturing. And, you know, obviously these are a lot of things that people wouldn't want getting out into the water supply. And so, yeah, like you said, it's boiled down into this kind of sludge that sometimes called a waste cake, and it's, you know, put in barrels, and, you know, then the question becomes, well, where are these barrels going? Is there a danger of the barrels leaking and things like that? And, you know, it can be all kinds of stuff. You know, for example, copper and cadmium, you know, all things that can be, you know, troublesome water contaminants. Copper is actually something that is supposed to be in your body in some small amount, but obviously too much of it isn't good.
Is the state of Wisconsin set up to monitor for some of these elements that you're talking about that might be what we're not used to testing for in a municipal water supply?
Well, I mean, there has been, there is some doubt about that because, you know, obviously there have been, you know, the audits of the DNR recently that have really cast doubt on how capable the DNR is of enforcing state regulations. And there's also these broader doubts of whether there's political will to enforce those regulations. And, you know, there are small electronics manufacturing operations in Wisconsin here and there, but it certainly does seem that electronics manufacturing on this scale will kind of be a new one for the state.
And you've been tracking this issue of water when it comes to Foxconn. What are you watching for next as the story develops?
Well, I guess I'm watching for more details about, you know, how much of it they're going to use. It'll be interesting to see how other states in the Great Lakes Basin react to this if they, you know, try to bring some kind of action through the Great Lakes Compact body and things like that. You know, it'll be interesting to see what kind of issues arise with water treatment and with potential contamination when this starts up, and how a company that's largely used to dealing with countries that don't have very strict environmental regulations and have huge environmental problems like China, you know, operates under, you know, American environmental regulations.
Scott, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks so much, Veronica.
Scott Gordon is associate editor for wiscontext.org, where you can find all the reporting in their series on Foxconn and economic development in Wisconsin. Over the last decade, the number of opioid-related deaths has skyrocketed. Just last year, the Centers for Disease Control estimated that more than 64,000 people died from overdoses. And today, President Trump officially declared the opioid crisis as a national public health emergency.
The fact is, this is a worldwide problem. This crisis of drug use, addiction, and overdose deaths, in many years, it's just been so long in the making. Addressing it will require all of our effort, and it will require us to confront the crisis in all of its very real complexity.
President Trump outlined a number of initiatives to combat that crisis, including more aid to states and first responders, a crackdown on imports of fentanyl, and more. Dr. Chris Iberlein is an emergency physician at Gunderson Health System in La Crosse, and he's with us to take a closer look at President Trump's announcement today. Dr. Iberlein, welcome back to Central Time.
Oh, thank you very much.
What was your reaction to what the president had to say about the opioid crisis?
A lot of it was expected. It's what we've been pushing for a long time. I think a lot of people will be disappointed that it didn't go far enough, but I think it's a good first step on where we're trying to get. And hopefully when the full report is released next week, we're able to see a little bit more in detail what he's proposing.
And one of the first things President Trump said he'd like to do is to create an awareness campaign on the dangers of opioids. What do you think would need to happen within that campaign for it to have the most impact?
Yeah, that's actually a really interesting point you brought up, because we've been talking locally about looking at young people's perception of drugs, and their perception of harm of these illicit drugs has actually gone down. So they're perceiving these drugs as less harmful than they really are, which is really concerning for the future when you're looking at middle schoolers and elementary schoolers and high schoolers thinking that the harm isn't there. And we were actually talking locally just today at our task force meeting about how to reach them and whether or not a media campaign would be helpful. So hopefully this actually will have a big impact. I'm hoping they put the finances needed and they really can change that perception amongst our youth as far as the harm that these drugs cause.
As far as who to target in a campaign like that, there are young people that we care about as people who will be growing up and taking a leadership role in our society. But I understand it's a huge scope of people. It's not just young people. Can you give us a sense of the breadth of people that we're talking about here?
Yeah, we need to focus on the young people for sure to make them realize these drugs are harmful. In addition, we need to focus on their families and the adults and the households, because a lot of the work you can do for prevention can be easily undone at the home. And so we really have to focus on the parents and the family members so that message is continued at home rather than just in the schools. And so it really is important to get the whole spectrum educated on this problem.
Now, the president also said he'd like to train prescribers to be better equipped to handle and identify abuse. What role do people who prescribe opioids play in all this?
They hold a huge role. We know that 80% of our heroin addicts started with prescription drugs. And better education on their prescribers and better monitoring of their prescribing practices, I think, are both really needed to start to combat this. Whether the other thing that I've mentioned and we've been talking about is some sort of risk identification models, screening tools at the doctor's offices to help identify patients that are higher risk of harm from opiates as well.
And that idea is one that has been floated. It's been in various stages of development in Wisconsin. Are there any states that have a good handle on identifying those risk factors?
Not that I've seen. I think this is something early on and that we have to really look at where to go with this, because there's a lot of screening tools out there, but which one is effective and actually would be not too time-consuming, too, because our healthcare providers are busy and these things take time for every patient visit.
Another interesting point in all of this, the president is championing the push to find new non-addictive painkillers. Does that seem like something that's on the horizon?
Well, that would be great, obviously, if we could do that. But we all have to remember that a lot of the drugs that we have problems with now were all billed as non-addictive pain medicines when they were initially started. So that always makes me a little nervous when I hear that line. Because everything from heroin itself was originally a non-addictive pain medicine developed as an alternative to other to opioids or to opium, and so we've heard that line over and over again. So I hope that I'd rather see us focus on prevention and some other modalities. Obviously, it'd be great if we could develop truly non-addictive pain medicine, but that is kind of how we got to the point we are now.
Other than prevention, what else is there?
Well, prevention is by far the most important component of this. We also have to keep focusing on limiting the opiates that we have in our system. And we are prescribing millions of pills. 80% of some of these narcotics are prescribed in America, and we're not 80% of the population of the world. So it's important to continue to limit our prescribing practices, and a lot of that comes with utilizing our prescription drug databases, which should be national, by the way. I would really like to see a national drug database. Ours in Wisconsin, we're fortunate because we're able to see the states around us, but there are some states that still don't even have one. So that's something that should be nationalized, or at least supported to be a national program. We have to continue to educate our providers. The CDC has excellent recommendations on best practices, but not everyone uses them. And so that's something else that we have to continue to educate and push forward.
We're talking to Dr. Chris Eberlein right now, an emergency physician at Gunderson Health System. And we're talking about the recent decision by President Trump to declare a public health emergency due to the ongoing opioid crisis in the country. Wisconsin hit especially hard as well. And you were mentioning other drugs that play a role, and fentanyl has been a huge culprit in the ongoing opioid crisis, and the president wants to see movement on trafficking of that drug stopped. First of all, can you give us a refresher on fentanyl and why it's dangerous?
Sure. Fentanyl is a very commonly used drug in the operating room and in emergency departments throughout our country. It's a very powerful opiate. It has great pain control for acute fractures and trauma, and it doesn't have, and it's very short acting too, which is nice for, so you can reevaluate patients. However, it is an extremely strong synthetic opioid. It is 50 to 100 times stronger than heroin. So what has happened is it has been produced oftentimes overseas. It gets shipped into our country, and it is sold as heroin. And the end user ends up injecting this drug that's 50 to 100 times stronger at the same volume that they were using their heroin, and it results in an overdose. And we actually had several deaths a few years ago, and that really kind of pushed us as a community here in La Crosse to get Narcan more widely distributed in our community because of these fentanyl deaths.
So do you think stopping that fentanyl that comes into the country, is that the way to go to stem some of those overdose deaths you're talking about?
Obviously, anytime you reduce the supply of something that is so harmful is good, but you know, it all gets back to the point of we really need to have people not addicted to these drugs in the first place. So, but yeah, the less fentanyl we have in our areas, in our communities, in our state, the better off we are, because it is a very, very dangerous drug. But it's just one of many synthetics. So you focus on one, there may be another that pops up. You know, carfentanil is another one, and that's another synthetic opiate that is even stronger than fentanyl. And there has been deaths related to that as well.
Chris Eberline, Dr. Chris Eberline with us right now, an emergency physician at Gunderson Health System, with us as we look at the recent decision by President Trump to declare a public health emergency due to the ongoing opioid crisis. And we want to hear from you. You can give us a call at 800-642-1234. Have you or your family been impacted by the opioid crisis? What are your thoughts on it being declared a public health emergency? And what do you think needs to change? You can call us at 800-642-1234 or leave a comment on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We're continuing our conversation about President Trump's decision to declare a public health emergency when it comes to the opioid crisis that has affected every state in the country. And you can join us by calling 800-642-1234. What are your thoughts on the president's decision today? What would you like to see change in your community, in our approach to tackling the opioid crisis? Has this been something that's touched you personally? Call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. And you can also send your comments to ideas@wpr.org. And Dr. Chris Eberline stays with us, emergency physician at Gunderson Health System. And we take our first call now. We've got Peter joining us in Madison. Peter, hi.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. The thing that I think is missing and what I was listening to the radio leading up to this is the role that the drug companies played in this crisis and the way that they realized that they can make a lot of money if they got people prescribed to these drugs long-term, and the sophisticated marketing they did to physicians to get them to prescribe these drugs. So I think in terms of a public policy, I hope that there's more regulations on the drug companies so they can't make a massive amount of money like this and then people have all these medical problems resulting from it.
Peter, thanks a lot for that. And Dr. Eberline, you're an emergency room physician. Do you see something to that argument that Peter made?
Yeah, for sure. In fact, one of the pharmaceuticals that came up with one of the drugs that has caused a lot of problems actually pleaded guilty to misleading advertising and paid a $600 million fine. So we know that really was a component. And my career has been interesting because when I started, I kind of saw this full circle. I started, it was pretty rare. We prescribed these drugs in training, and then as time went on, we were told they were less and less of a problem and that we should be treating pain more. And a lot of that was fueled by misleading education and advertising by some of the drug companies.
Peter, thank you for that. And I want to ask you actually quickly before we move on, Dr. Eberline, I mean, how do you approach changing the culture of prescription drugs from the manufacturing standpoint, from the companies?
Well, I think it comes down to providers being a little bit better educated on the danger of these medications. I think they're much more aware of that now. But that gets back to my point before about the developing non-addictive medications. And we have to make sure when they actually come out that they're truly non-addictive and we don't end up in the same boat we are now.
Let's go to Lisa. She's joining us next in Green Bay. Lisa, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to share?
Well, I'd really like to share the fact that, the doctor was addressing the fact that we need to look at prevention, but the real crisis that we're facing right now is the fact that these addicts have no chance to receive treatment. Their resources are really limited right now. We don't have, most of the addicts that I see or deal with, the issue is they don't have insurance or they have Badger Care. And none of those things covers any type of inpatient treatment. So long-sustained treatment is going to be an assurance for a better chance at recovery. That's what I kind of wanted to address. And also, I just wanted to mention there's an awesome group in Wisconsin, and they are a speaking group called Rise Together. And they are really making some great progress and waves, spreading the word about addiction and all the reasons that people use drugs, and kind of spreading awareness and breaking that stigma, because I think that's another big issue we really need to address, is that there's a problem with the stigma.
Lisa, thanks for that. A bunch of good points there. Lisa talking about the stigma and also about access to treatment and insurance to get it.
Couldn't agree with her more. She hit on great points on all of them. The stigma is still there. I think we've made some improvement, but it's definitely still a big component of the disease process. And treatment is very difficult to get people into at times. And we really have to continue to look at ways to get people into treatment, different treatments to get better access, and to intervene at the right time to get people to the treatment at that time that they need as well.
In terms of the stigma, that seems like it could be a difficult one to get at in terms of public awareness. What do you suggest for combating that?
Yeah, the stigma is something that we've worked very hard at trying to change, because unless people start to see this as a disease and they stop blaming the addicted person, it's very difficult to get people to want to help them. And that includes tax dollars and money to get into treatment programs. I think a lot of it is letting the public know that this isn't just the stereotypical person they see in their mind that is the drug user. It is your neighbor, your friend oftentimes. I mean, it really comes across all socioeconomic states and really has been shown to affect people across our city. We recently did a study here, and it showed that a lot of our addicts were college educated. Most people would have never thought that. And so it's really coming to light how much this has gone through our society and how many people really have become affected by it.
Dr. Eberlein, thanks a lot for being with us today.
Oh, thanks for having me.
That was Dr. Chris Eberlein. He's an emergency physician at Gunderson Health System in La Crosse, medical director for Tri-State Ambulance, and medical advisor for Region 4 for the Wisconsin Healthcare Coalition, joining us there to talk about President Trump's move today to declare the opioid crisis a public health emergency.